Your biggest lesson learned going from like the single family, making the jump into multifamily, if you were to verbalize that in a couple of sentences, what would that be?
I would say that there's just no substitute for networking, and it is hard to spend too much time networking and meeting people, because inevitably with any deal, you're going to run into problems that you don't know how to solve. Mm-hmm. And these are almost always problems that somebody else has solved before. And of course, they're problems that somebody else can help you solve. And you need to know who you can pick up the phone and call, or who you can send out an email to. I'm doing the best I can trying to network more and meet people like you and be out sharing what I've learned so I can be a resource for others and so that we could work together. I would say that I wish I'd been doing that at a bigger scale and doing that earlier so that I could raise more money and take down more and bigger deals.
This is the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast, and I'm your host, Brian Briscoe. Now, this podcast is designed for the aspiring apartment investor and literally gives them the opportunity to ask the questions that will help them get to the next level. So if you're an aspiring apartment investor, this podcast is for you. Now, this podcast is brought to you by the Tribe of Titans Multifamily Educational Community. It's your one-stop shop for learning how to succeed at apartment investing. Welcome to the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast. I'm your host, Brian Briscoe. I'm really excited for today's show. We got Alex Cartwright on with us today, and we're just going to be talking a lot of multifamily stuff. So, Alex, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Brian.
All right. Well, do us a favor. Tell us a little bit about yourself to start out.
Sure. I am an economics professor at Ferris State University. And when I became an economics professor, I realized that I was never going to be incredibly wealthy doing it, but it's an insanely rewarding job. Get to read and write about things that interest me and help young people, teach them things that I think have a great impact on the world, which is the important role of business. But as I was searching around for something to do, I decided to move forward and start investing in real estate. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of people, started off with two units and then bought another two and another two and another two. Mm-hmm. And for the last year and a half, have been in the syndication space. And nice. So I'm trying to grow more in that space.
Awesome. Yeah, I wish I would have doubled up when I started buying. I started buying single family homes instead of duplexes. So I guess you're twice as good as I am.
Oh, I doubt it. But you started buying. So you're way better than most people.
Yeah.
I talk to my students all the time and I say, guys, you have got to get a duplex as soon as you graduate. Oh, yeah. You've got to do it before you get a family and you can't fit in a 1, 2, 3 bedroom unit and you become pickier on what neighborhood you live in, or you've got a spouse or someone else that's not on board. And I say, we all know you've got to get your money compounding and your biggest expense is probably your housing. It's probably around a third of your income. Yep. You probably can't go to graduate school for a couple years and raise your income by a third. Right? If you buy a duplex, you're effectively raising your income by a third and you don't have to give away any more of your time to do it. Like you can't not do it. You're a fool if you don't do it. And as you well know, go and get an FHA loan, 3.5% down.
Yeah.
Like, is that building going to appreciate 3% in a year? Yes. And you capture all of that upside. Yeah. I mean, it's not guaranteed that it appreciates, of course, but what's the likelihood it doesn't appreciate 3.5% in the first 24 months very you own low. It? Very little.
Yeah.
But to your point about only doing single family, like you started, Brian, I pitched this as hard as I can to 200 students that are about to graduate every year. And I can count, I think, 3 people in the last 4 years that have taken me up on it. Mm-hmm. Now, those people are all very happy. Everyone else has a lame excuse.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Something you mentioned reminded me of a conversation I had with my wife. I mean, I was probably, you know, mid-30s with 4 kids. And I was like, let's go buy a fourplex. That's when I first kind of was introduced to the idea of the house hacking concept. You know, buy a fourplex on an FHA loan, you know. And my wife looked at me and was like, yeah, where are we going to find a fourplex that has one unit big enough for our family? I'm like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. We'll find one. She's like, no. Yeah. So, yeah, I think your advice is sound there. I mean, having tried to do it in my mid-30s, Yeah. If you can do that when you're 20 something, just out of college, I mean, do it.
Especially when there's not a lot of, you may live in a market where there aren't a lot of fourplexes or duplexes. Yeah. Like if you're in a market where these things are available in any part of your city, you better mm-hmm. think seriously. You need to have a compelling reason for why you're not doing it.
Yep. There was a duplex. A buddy of mine was doing some wholesaling and he found a duplex in Salt Lake, which is where my daughters live. And yeah, I was thinking for my girls, I'm like, hey, let's get this duplex and everything. I mean, just for them too. Mm-hmm. So same mm-hmm. thing. And of course I showed him the picture of it. And my girl's like, I can't live there, you know, but.
Yeah. But here's what you tell them, Brian. You say, look, honey, if you want pretty, you go to Nordstrom and buy, we're not buying pretty here. We're making money. That's what we're doing. Right.
Absolutely.
It's all about what does the customer want? And there's demand for people to have clean, affordable workforce housing. Right. Absolutely. We're entrepreneurs here. We're trying to fulfill the customer needs, not buy what's the prettiest.
We take care of demand, you know, and I mean, as somebody who's owned a lot of C-class, I mean, we've owned a lot of not pretty apartments, you know, and that's just a fact. You know, a lot of them you buy them, it's like, man, that thing's ugly. As a matter of fact, you know, I almost enjoy it when the brokers send me an ugly property because I know what to do with it. It's like, all right.
Sure.
Yeah, there's the
opportunity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I go to my favorite designer. And I'm like, hey, can you do a little color scheme on this? Tell me how to make it pretty. I know what pretty looks like. I don't know how to make something pretty, you know, but I know people who shop at Nordstrom's, you know, and they take care of it for me. So, well, cool. So you talk about all the duplexes and then getting into a larger property. Mm-hmm. What was it like making the jump from two to your first, I guess, larger apartment complex?
Well, I had people that had watched me buy half dozen duplexes and knew that it was going well. Mm-hmm. And they had seen pictures of the renovations I had done and they knew about the success raising the rents. And they wanted me to find duplexes on their behalf. Mm-hmm. And so I started off doing some JV deals, taking some capital from folks to identify a smaller multifamily. And I had more people coming to me now, not like I had dozens of people, but different friends and family that wanted to place capital. And I had heard of the syndication. And so I started looking at larger multifamily. There was a beautiful 8-unit that came available in a neighborhood that I was very familiar with, went to look at it, was on a Friday, and on Sunday it was under contract. And I was really excited to make that jump from doing these twos and fours to the 8-unit. I was disappointed when that left, but the lady that owned it said, you know, I'm retiring and I also have this 14 unit that I haven't put on the market yet. Mm-hmm. Let me show you that. Maybe you're interested in that before I go through the trouble of putting it on the market.
Yeah, perfect.
And so perfect, right? That's everybody's dream. And so I think the lesson from that is you just got to be out there talking to people. Like the only way that you get lucky is be in the place where lucky people are.
Oh, yeah.
So I go and I look at this 14 unit, absolutely beautiful property, A-class property, core of downtown Grand Rapids. Lady that owned it had over rehabbed it really, Brian. Yeah. She had put solid wood closet organizers in every closet. She had put brand new real wood throughout every unit. These are things that you do not really get a premium bump in rent for doing that. And she had granite in every kitchen, every bathroom, solid wood cabinets everywhere. And it's like she kind of ran out of money at the end because all this nice stuff and then black appliances everywhere. So it's 14 units and they were all rented way under market. Mm-hmm. So there were $800 and $700 a month studio and one bedrooms that we now have at between $1,400 and $2,000. Mm-hmm. So it was just a matter. It was really a great deal for a first time syndicator because in terms of the value add, we didn't have to make a lot of physical changes, did some painting, did some cleaning, and then we were just patient, waited for the leases to expire, put up with a little bit of vacancy to get those rents up. And now we're returning over 20% cash on cash to the investors.
Man, those are nice numbers, really nice numbers there. So yeah. And I mean, over renovating is a thing and you just gotta, that's something that I ask a lot when we start coming into plans, you know, to do our next, you know, value add is, you know, where's just the right spot, you know, kind of like the three bears, the mama bear, you know, you don't want to be too hard or Actually, the mama bear is too soft, isn't she? Right. You want to be like baby bear. Just right.
Back to your point about your daughter wanting something that's pretty. I think even in the midst of a rehab, we want to do things that are pretty. And you get excited about changing the paint colors and the new cabinets and the hardware, et cetera. And I'll tell you what, I've also under rehabbed. And I think you under rehab when you sit down and you're really trying to calculate the ROI on every last little light switch and faucet, et cetera. You don't want to do it that minutely because you want to look at the renovations, I think, in totality. To use you want to look at the synergy or the gestalt of the whole package together and ask, is that entire package worth it? So it's a careful balance, and that just comes with experience. And in terms of getting it just right, for example, try really hard not to buy those Glacier Bay faucets or toilets. The $99 toilet, like, that sucker breaks one time. What does that cost you in terms of somebody's time and parts to get it fixed? Whereas the $150 or $200 toilet, it's going to break less than half as much, if at all. Yeah. Totally worth it to me. So I've learned to not skimp on like the toilets, the faucets, and not get the absolute cheapest appliances, but at the same time, not get too excited about the design.
Yeah, it's quality. I mean, and everybody knows, you know, cheaper isn't always better, you know, and that's kind of the line you try to, the line in the sand that you try to find where you're getting the good quality, but you're also not, you know, especially when you're looking at workforce housing, you know, you don't want to over-renovate. Now, speaking of things that I think a lot of people miss, like the hardware, you know, I've seen a couple of units where people come in and they'll put new flooring in, they'll paint. And they leave the old hardware, you know, whether it's the kitchen poles or the doorknobs or whatever. Yeah.
And the hinges that can make the place look so nice and fresh to put on new hinges and doorknobs, or to even go around and install new quarter round or baseboard. You know, MDF is not cost that much. And that baseboard gets banged up and 10,000 coats of paint on it over time. To go in and put new baseboard and quarter round, that really freshens the place up. And it's not just about getting that higher rent dollar, right? It's also about keeping the occupancy there, right? Once the people are in, if it's quality and it continues to look nice, they want to stay. And we all know that the biggest cost in this business is vacancy.
Mm-hmm. Every time you turn a unit, I mean, you have that downtime and you're pumping more money into it. There's always broke stuff to fix, you know? So yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, all right. So you got that 14 unit. You said that was also Grand Rapids?
Yeah, it was in Grand Rapids. That was $2.3 million. The lady was very stuck on her price. When it's off market, you've got less bargaining power in terms of the price sometimes. And this was back in 2021. So market was hot. Cap rates were low. Interest rates were low. She wanted 2.5. I knew I wasn't paying 2.5. I signed a contract for 2.5 to get it locked up. And took it to loan broker, took it to CBRE to try and put the agency debt on it. And at the current rents, it didn't meet the DSCR requirements. And also on a property that small, we were not going to make the occupancy requirements if we had more than one vacant. And that was painful because then she would have to re-sign somebody at a lower rate to make sure we were 90%+ occupied in order to satisfy the lender. And so I sat down with her for maybe 2.5 hours and explained that at this price, we don't meet the DSCR requirements. And that if this is what she wants, this price, I could give her $2.3 million, but I wanted interest only for 7 years. And I wanted to put down 20% and that she would do a land contract at 4%. And she agreed to that. And retirement, that interest payment every month was nice. For her, she's secured by the building, of course. We sidestepped a whole bunch of lender fees and other closing costs. And then things were a lot more flexible in terms of what insurance we got, no appraisal, inspection, everything was just a lot more straightforward. And we moved forward and closed less than 30 days later.
Nice. The longest pull in the tent, as I say, is always the lender. They're the ones that take the longest to process everything and get everything done. And we're seeing 60 to 90 days. But yeah, if you're doing seller financing, and that's something that can be done that quick. And if you got the equity there, there's no reason it takes any longer than 30 days. So
exactly.
Nice. Well, that sounds amazing. And, you know, congratulations. Looks like it's all working out extremely well right now.
Yeah, thank you. The hard part, the downside of it is now everybody's spoiled and wants to repeat that. And that's just a hard situation to repeat, as I'm sure you, as you know, definitely in today's market.
Yeah.
So I kept shopping, wanted to do the same thing again, but cap rates continue to fall, prices go up, and sellers became greedy. And even as interest rates have risen, the sales prices have not come down that much. And I think that's because we still have a huge shortage of housing and rents will continue to grow. But because of that, there aren't really, I can't find the same deal, or I can't generate the same kind of returns consistently. And I realized going out and shopping for these deals that there wasn't really an edge that I don't have hundreds of millions or tens of millions of investor dollars. I don't have a big track record. I don't have special connections with the banks to get the absolute best rates. And therefore, I couldn't offer the returns to my investors that a big syndicator could offer. And so I thought, why am I going to continue to try and compete in this game? I could try and be in the place to get lucky again, but I was worried that wasn't scalable. And so that's when I started looking at hotels that could be converted into workforce housing. And once I learned that game and became to understand what those numbers look like, then that's where I've been focused the last 16 months.
Well, let's talk about what that looks like as far as pricing. I mean, is the pricing competitive? And, you know, obviously there's some rezoning involved. Kind of walk us through that process. Tell us what that looks like.
Sure. When I first heard about this, I was at a conference talking to people that were looking at converting hotels into multifamily. Yep. And so generally what that means for those that aren't familiar is taking a property that was perhaps an old motel, making physical changes to the property, which is usually adding kitchen and fire suppression, and then getting it rezoned or at least re-recognized by the municipality as a multifamily. Sometimes you change every room into a studio, sometimes combine rooms to make bigger units. It depends on just empirically which works out to be the most profitable. So I heard of the strategy and I thought to myself, what an absolute pain in the butt. You gotta find an old hotel, and then you've gotta find a seller that is going to agree to take the branding and the franchise off that hotel, which sometimes comes with liquidated damages, right? If you've got a Motel 6 or a Days Inn or something, those are franchises. And so if the seller calls up and they're in the middle of their 7-year contract, they want to take that name off the hotel. In the hotel world, they call it the flag. To remove the flag could be $50,000-$100,000 in what they call liquidated damages or early franchise termination fees.
Yeah. Kind of like a prepayment penalty is what that is.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Prepayment penalty. Yeah. So then you got to find the municipality that is going to allow you to make the conversion into a multifamily, right? They'll allow the zoning to change. And then you've got to find the property where the construction is such that you can easily add the electricity and the additional plumbing that you need for the kitchens in every unit. And this is all on top of finding a good price, finding it in the right market, in the right location, everything that you'd look for at the traditional multifamily deal. So I heard all this and I thought, this is just way too much.
I mean, the way you say it, it sounds like a needle in a haystack.
Exactly. It sounds like a needle. Like I might as well just keep looking for great multifamily deals. But I made a mistake. And this is the mistake that when any problem comes up, like what good entrepreneurs do, I think, is they put a number on that problem. Like, it's an ugly property. Put a number on it. It's in a crappy location. Put a number on it. It's got lots of bad debt. It's got lots of vacancy. Okay, put numbers on those things and see whether or not it is worth trying to solve those problems. And so I sat down and tried to put numbers on those problems of convincing the city of what it would take to get the franchise off and what it would cost to buy the hotel. And I was just blown away by the gains. And so long story short, figuring out how to solve those problems is worth it. And as I've dug into it over the last year and a half, solving them is not that hard. It's like most things, looks like a mystery at the beginning, but other people have done it. And so you learn from them and you figure out what to do. So the first thing I do in terms of vetting an area is, one, not all areas even have zoning. So mm-hmm. Houston, Texas, for example, no zoning. Pretty straightforward to do conversion, and that's why I've got some properties under contract there. Number two, if you're looking in a market where they do have stricter zoning, you pull up the city's master plan and look at how often something like the words adaptive use is cited in the master plan mm-hmm. or alternative housing or something along the lines of a need to bring on additional affordable housing, all of these mm-hmm. things. If that's in their master plan, their strategic plan, which almost all cities have, when you approach them, you can say, hey, I noticed this is one of the initiatives that you guys have, which, by the way, all these local politicians want to look like they're fulfilling to get reelected. I can help you get closer to those initiatives if you allow the zoning change. Where I've been part of going through and applying to make this change, like one time in San Antonio, we went through and made the application and it was granted. And then you get two people on your team to help you. Number one, you find a broker that has managed this process with the city before. And number two, you get an architect that has managed this process with the city before, mm-hmm. and you can get it done.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Taking their own city plan and kind of using it in your favor against them. I mean, not really against mm-hmm. them. You're working with them, mm-hmm. probably the better way to put it. You look to see mm-hmm. what the cities are trying to accomplish. And mm-hmm. I mean, you kind of fit your project into there. So mm-hmm. I love it.
But you asked, I'm sorry I didn't answer your question directly in terms of the pricing. So yeah. Like in Houston, for example, whereas Class C multifamily, we're looking at maybe low 100,000s per unit. Mm-hmm. You can buy, even under contract, on extended stay hotels, meaning mm-hmm. those are hotels with kitchens in every unit already.
Yep.
You can get that. Great area, great condition, high 40s per unit. Mm-hmm. Even older motels, and I'm not even talking about stuff that is not operational, fully operational stuff. You can get for mid-20s to low-30s per unit. We're talking like a half to one-third of the multifamily price. And by the way, this mm-hmm. is for a product that you can turn around and rent for $700 to $900 a month. Nobody can build mm-hmm. that. And that's where there's the most demand. That's where there's the highest occupancy. That's where there's mm-hmm. high collection, right? All the rest. And once you get in there and make that conversion to multifamily, it's not just a physical conversion. It's also a financial conversion. You mm-hmm. get that multi-family cap rate placed on the building, which is a lot lower than a hospitality cap rate. And boom, all of a sudden, you've got a huge windfall for your investors.
Yeah. Nice. So what markets, I mean, you mentioned Houston. What makes Houston such a great place to be doing this?
Glad to tell you. Mm-hmm. So I love Houston because, first of all, because the regulatory environment, and there's other people that have done it. So there's proof of concept at the city level, and they're open to allowing it. You combine that with the fact that Houston was the second most popular place for people to move in 2021. It's the fourth largest city in the country. It's home to almost 30 Fortune 500 companies. Mm-hmm. Like there's just, even in the middle of an economic catastrophe, I can't imagine where Houston, Texas starts losing jobs and population, right? Mm-hmm. And they've got tons of population growth and tons of job growth. That's ultimately what drives demand for housing and household formation. So that's a big box, check, and the zoning, check. On top of that, Houston is really oversupplied with hotels. There mm-hmm. are tons of hotels for sale in Houston. And what does that mean? You can buy them at a competitive price. Mm-hmm. So but those reasons alone are enough to focus on Houston. But I look at everywhere in Texas. I know there where I am in West Michigan, love West Michigan and look there. I have looked at these properties essentially in every major U.S. market. Mm-hmm. But Texas is really the sweet spot because of the combination of that population growth and the favorable regulatory environment.
Yeah. Yeah. And you also mentioned, I mean, the oversaturation of the hotels to begin with. So, I mean, you're buying at a good price. You have population growth. You have a demand for housing. And I mean, end of the day, you buy something for, you know, one third of what it costs to buy existing multifamily and boom, sounds like a pretty nice.
Right. And really what that translates into is if you're buying it at a third of the cost of multifamily is it's not just lots of upside. that's protected downside, right? Even if as the multifamily, if there was some kind of economic catastrophe and multifamilies were to fall in value, which in my opinion is extremely unlikely, then who's going to be most insulated from that? The people that bought in at the lowest prices. And that'll be the people that own these hotels and got them converted.
Yeah. Now, a lot of hotel rooms are small. What do you find the demand for the smaller units as far as rentals?
So two things on that. One, most hotel rooms are around 300 square feet, 350 to like low 400s would be a big hotel room. And those properties are out there. If you can try and find an extended stay hotel or an all suite hotel, those will have bigger rooms. It very rarely makes sense to combine rooms, but you can do it. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, most people don't want to live in a hotel room. However, if it's a problem, you put a price on it. And so you've just got to compensate for that with a lower rental price. And I'll say there are a couple things that we do. Number one, we make sure that there's phenomenal amenities outside of the room. Because people that have got a small room, they may not want to spend all their time in it. So really nice gym, really nice pool, really nice co-working space, right? And so we put a lot of thought into the lobby area / clubhouse of these hotels. A lot of them have restaurant space. We think really hard about how we can repurpose that to keep the residents happy. That's number one. But number two, we have model units with some creative furniture to show people how these can be laid out. And I don't know about you, Brian, but when I go to IKEA and I see those creatively designed like small spaces, like part of it's exciting to me. Like, oh, I kind of like the idea of not having a lot of stuff and not having to manage a lot of stuff and it being clean and decluttered and you know where everything
simple.
Is.
Yeah.
Right. We try and market the properties as an opportunity to live that way.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, we got to compete on price because you got lower square footage. So what do? Well, we can offer things like cable and internet included. Mm-hmm. Those are very cheap when for a hotel owner to compare to multifamily, we're paying like $10 a unit for internet or something. Mm-hmm. And so we try and sign on contracts with those service providers and include that in the rent or charge the tenant something very minimal for stuff like cable and internet. That's a big value add to somebody that is looking to pay $700-$900 a month in rent. And then because we're buying these things as hotels, they come with furnishings in them. So to the extent that somebody wants furnishings and we can leave them in there, there's another great value add or is another big plus for the tenant. It's turnkey. They get to move right in. However, the most economically challenging part of this, which you're bringing up with the small square foot, is the lease-up period, right? So when you take over an apartment building, you're going to add value to, it's got a bunch of income on day one, right? Yeah. You're at least paying the bills with the income that's coming in even before you raise rent. Whereas like a hotel that we have under contract right now, 146 units in Sugar Land, that property right now has got something like 20 rooms of people that have stayed over 100 days. And so we're gonna get that thing essentially 70% vacant. You can't pay your bill 70% vacant. So you got to lease up quickly. You got to lease up quickly and you gotta raise some money to keep in reserves. And so that's a real balancing act on how high do we keep the rents, but we also don't want to delay the lease up. Right. And so what we look at is working with local charities or housing authority. They're trying to help people transition and the people qualify for vouchers for different things. And we can get money straight from the local municipality if they'll take 10 rooms, 20 rooms, 30 rooms right in the beginning, or rent some rooms by the month or by the week in the beginning to get the occupancy up. However, it'll take, whereas sometimes developers can lease up 20 plus units a month, we're looking to lease up more like 15 units a month, right? Because it's a smaller unit and that's a different kind of tenant that wants to be in there. Tenants are out there. Takes time to find them.
Yeah. I was talking with somebody fairly recently that was doing a hotel conversion. And you know, one of the things they did, which I thought was quite creative, is the hotel had a couple of wings and they closed one wing down to renovate it. And they operated the other wing, you know, one or two of the other wings as, you know, hospitality still. So they kept the hotel open, started, you know, renovating one side of it. And, you know, I don't know what that would take with the city and what coordination or planning would take. But, you know, I thought it was a pretty creative idea to keep the money coming in.
That is a very creative idea. We have looked at doing the exact same thing. We've looked at even delaying the legal conversion just to run it as a hotel some, or even put a lot of units on an Airbnb in the interim. Here's the issue you run into. The big returns to the investors come once we refinance as a multifamily. And to do that, we really want to be able to show 6 to 12 months of rent, right? And occupancy. And if you've got leases that are shorter than 30 days, that income is not going to count multifamily. And so we can't really dedicate more than 10% of the units to stuff that rents by the week, even though we can get $400 or $500 a week for a lot of these rooms. Mm-hmm. So what you've got to do is you've got to find a property manager that understands the conversion game. And here's what you say to them. You say, hey, property manager, you guys, under a different entity, you turn around and lease from me 20 or 30 units at the long-term rental rate. And then you guys turn around and rent them to traveling nurses or by the week or whatever you want to do with them to operate them on the corporate end. And whatever the delta is between that monthly rate and the weekly rate, you guys, the property manager, you guys can keep all that money. And that way we get to show on our books that we have all this stuff leased out long-term to satisfy the lender, and both people win.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Another creative solution to keep a little bit of cash flowing. Well, hey, we're about out of time today. So I guess we'll close it up with your biggest lesson learned going from like the single family, making the jump into multifamily. If you were to verbalize that in a couple of sentences, what would that be?
I would say that there's just no substitute for networking, and it is hard to spend too much time networking and meeting people, because inevitably with any deal, you're going to run into problems that you don't know how to solve. Mm-hmm. And these are almost always problems that somebody else has solved before. And of course, they're problems that somebody else can help you solve. And you need to know who you can pick up the phone and call, or who you can send out an email to. I'm doing the best I can trying to network more and meet people like you and be out sharing what I've learned so I can be a resource for others and so that we can work together. I would say that I wish I'd been doing that at a bigger scale and doing that earlier so that I could raise more money and take down more and bigger deals.
Well, let's see. As a follow-up to that, you know, if listeners want to connect with you and start that process along, how can they do that?
Sure. Our website's Villicus, V-I-L-I-C-U-S. Villicus stands for steward in Latin. And as an academic, I like the given Latin names to things. I think it sounds very official. Yep. But of course, you can send me an email, alexcartwright@villicus.capital. Would love to hear from you and happy to be a resource on anything related to hotel conversion.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks. Appreciate your time today. Thanks for coming on the show, and I can tell you're excited about it. And it sounds like a really, really good way to, you know, keep on doing multifamily.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening to the Diary of an Apartment Investor podcast by the Tribe of Titans. If you're still listening, you obviously liked it. So go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, leave a 5-star rating and review if you haven't already, and then make sure to check out our YouTube channel, which incidentally has a ton of video content that you'll also enjoy and learn from. Now, if you're interested in being on the show, go to our website, diaryofanapartmentinvestor.com, and fill out the questionnaire on the website. And for more educational content and for more information about our educational community, check us out at thetribeoftitans.info.